In the first lecture of this series, I looked at witchcraft in general terms and characterized it in a number of ways, fitting it into the way in which people react to superhuman power. What I want to do this time is to look in greater detail at some aspects of what has happened in relation to witchcraft in the area round the North Sea, and in particular in the British Isles, during the modern period. One of the things which one can emphasise from the very beginning in dealing with this period and in this area is that some rather strange things have happened to witchcraft. And what I want to do is to look at witchcraft in three distinct sections, though these three are related to each other, through the passage of time, since about 1500. The first section will need to deal with the extraordinary witch hunts of northwestern Europe, which occurred in and around the time of Shakespeare. And I then want to look at the development of what is now generally called the Enlightenment, which occurred slightly later than this, but again broadly in the northwest European area. And I then want to look at the way in which the very meaning of the word witchcraft has shifted through that modern period in this area, and particularly what witchcraft means in the English language at the end of the 20th century. First then, the peculiarities of northwestern Europe at the beginning of the modern period. I pointed out last week that witchcraft is an old word in English. Indeed, the word is older than the English language in its modern form, and it has its roots certainly back in Angle and Saxon dialects before the birth of England, and doubtless goes back into the very beginnings of the Teutonic languages somewhere, wherever it was, out there on the North European plain in late prehistory. Now, one of the striking features of European history, which one cannot expect, for example, necessarily to be paralleled in the Indian subcontinent or in the Far East, is the occurrence of massive witch hunts, which occurred quite particularly in the early modern period. Now, it's worth pointing out that to some extent the Hollywood images of feudal Europe are in fact somewhat misleading, that a lot of students have the impression that in the feudal period, say in the 12th century or thereabouts, there was a great deal of witch hunting. People were very frightened of witchcraft, and a great many people were accusing other people of witchcraft and seeking them out. One of the curious things is that when one looks at the records, although the knowledge of witchcraft was clearly, doubtless, widespread in, say, 12th century England, the amount of accusation was apparently very slight, and that the feudal period was not necessarily marked by a striking fear or a great upsurge of accusation of witchcraft. Whereas when we get into the early modern period, it's quite clear that the fear of witchcraft certainly was in the ascendant. If one watches what happens from the 14th through the 15th and then through the 16th centuries, you can see that the incidence of witchcraft accusation, that is, the socially accessible, readily observable, anthropologically immediately relevant face of witchcraft, increasing witchcraft accusation, is indeed a feature of these times. And through the 16th and into the early 17th centuries, if one watches what is going on in England and Scotland, then the number of people being hailed before the courts on charges of witchcraft and the processes of law which are going on around witchcraft accusations reach an extraordinary pitch, which climaxes in or around the reign of King James VI of Scotland, who in 1603 became also King James I of England. If one looks at records in the Low Countries, in Scandinavia, and on the German-speaking part of the North European plain, sort of broadly Lower Saxony, what one finds is that a very similar process is going on in this same period. Witch hunting must be distinguished from witchcraft accusations of a normal kind. Last week, I looked at the accusations which Zande in the interior of Africa were making against their neighbours in the 1920s during the period when Evans Pritchard was recording those accusations. And that picture of accusation, although, as I pointed out last time, one shouldn't take the Zande to be an absolutely typical African people, nevertheless, much of the process which is involved is the day-to-day, workaday world of witchcraft accusation. The Zande were not experiencing witch hunts at that time, and indeed it appears that witch hunting is very unusual. It has been recorded from more than one part of the world, but by far the clearest and by far the most gigantic examples of witch hunting that we know come from precisely northwestern Europe in the early modern period, the reign of King James, the time of Shakespeare, that period. Now, this doesn't fit too well, of course, with some modern human individuals' views of the difference between the civilized and the primitive society. A lot of modern Europeans would like to believe that the Zande are a thoroughly primitive people and that the English of Shakespeare's time were a thoroughly civilized people. But this doesn't sit too well with the notion that witch hunting is a primitive pursuit into which the civilized do not get involved. It's quite clear, of course, that quite apart from what one means by civilized and primitive, and I'm not going to use those words, but quite apart from what one means by those terms, it is quite clear that in the history of the British Isles and in the history of the countries round the North Sea, the great climax of witch hunting came around 1600. That is quite late in European history, firmly into the modern period, and among people who are, by the standards of some at least, allegedly civilized. Now, witch hunting is something which I won't attempt to explain at this point. I will simply comment upon the incidence of what was happening. That a witch hunt is not the normal workaday accusation of people which we associate with the Zande and indeed with the modern documentation of most African societies. We are not dealing here with an individual who accuses another individual, and the process of divination and, in some cases, of court action which follow from this accusation. In a witch hunt, what happens is that there is an initial flurry of accusations which then escalates. Indeed, in extreme cases of witch hunting, just about anybody in a locality can be accused. A very famous example of this is the outbreak of witchcraft accusations in the New England town of Salem, Massachusetts, which occurred in the 1690s and is actually quite late in the period of witch hunting, possibly because of colonial conservatism. Perhaps New England was dragging behind Old England in this respect. But this particular outbreak is well documented and takes place in circumstances which are absolutely classic, though rather isolated. If one goes back to the reign of King James in England and Scotland, nearly 100 years earlier, what one finds is that the series of witch hunts which occurred in various parts of Britain in that period follow exactly the same pattern as was later to occur in Salem, Massachusetts. You start with a fairly low-key flurry of accusations, but by the end of it, almost anybody could be accused. It is possible, I suppose, that by the end of King James' reign, there was a possibility that he himself might have been accused, and that members of his court could also be involved. They weren't, but the danger must have been there. The extraordinary feature of witch hunts is that they are, in a sense, out of control. They are processes by which the fear of witches gets to a point where almost anybody might accuse anybody. It is, however, worth pointing out that one shouldn't overdo the hysteria and the lack of control in England or Scotland during that period, because it is quite clear from the documents, and the documents are abundant, that the ordinary courts of the two countries continued to operate in their normal procedures. There was a certain strange biasing of the character of trials before the magistrates at this time, but the magistrates continued to sit, and it is quite clear that the normal procedures of the courts continued. People were brought before the courts, accused of witchcraft. The courts considered the case. They looked around for evidence. They heard witnesses. In many ways, this period, though extraordinary, is a very admirable advertisement for the magistrates of Scotland and England operating under rather peculiar conditions. It is worth pointing out that some people brought before the courts were acquitted, that these were not exactly kangaroo trials. People were brought before the courts and found not guilty. It didn't follow that because you were accused of being a witch, you would automatically be convicted of being a witch. The hysteria had not reached the point where the magistrates believed every single accusation brought before the courts. But of course, what we remember about those witch trials now is the very large number of people who were found guilty and who were executed. Now, in England and Scotland, the standard procedure for executing a witch was to hang them. A lot of people nowadays in England and Scotland have the imagery that witches are always burnt. The English and the Scots have never been burning people. They're definitely hanging people. And although there may have been burnings in continental Europe, in this part of the world, there were not. Now, the procedure of a witch hunt, when one looks back on it now, follows a very standard pattern, a pattern which we can see in some other parts of the world too. The witch hunt begins slowly, as I've said. It gains momentum. There are more and more and more accusations. And as the hunt goes on, so people come forward not only with proposals as to other people who are believed to be witches, but also with methods which they believe will help to find those people who are witches. I pointed out in the first lecture that one of the great differences between the England and the Scotland of King James and the Zande country of Evans Pritchard's time was that the English and the Scots did not have an infallible method for finding any kind of witches. There was no inevitable procedure by which those who had engaged in witchcraft could be hunted down and found. And this is important because, of course, clearly without such methods, the limits of witchcraft accusation could not be firmly established. Hence, of course, conditions in which a witch craze or a witch hunt could take off. The process, however, goes further. After a bit, the people who claim that they can find witches, the witch hunters, if you like, become suspect. The individual witch hunts did not last long. Although the period of the witch hunts lasts for generations, any individual witch hunt in a particular part of, say, Wessex, or a particularly part of Lowland Scotland, did not go on for long because suspicion of the processes involved very quickly set in. witch hunts are marked by a rapid process of disillusionment. In the case of a rather late example of witch hunting, which occurred during the English Civil War of the 1640s, a notorious character called Matthew Hopkins came forward, proclaiming himself eventually to be the Witchfinder General. As far as we know, he never had any recognition from either the parliamentary or the royal side in the Civil War. And his own amazing career, from his first appearance to disillusionment and his own eventual execution, is very rapid. Most of his career can be crowded into the single year 1645. So that witch hunts were self-destroying. They may have picked up enormous momentum at an early stage, but that momentum soon spent itself. There came a point in a witch hunt where people's fear of the witch finders, the witch hunters, actually becomes greater than their fear of the witches, and the confidence that the methods are working and that witches are being found disintegrates. So that the witch hunt collapses, and people find themselves in a position where, though there may well still be witches around, there is no confidence that we have any clear or recent methods of finding them. The confidence that the witch hunt can be pursued evaporates, and this version of it collapses. If you're living in a time of witch hunting, such as the one which I'm describing, what happens is that later, in the same area, or soon in an area nearby, another witch hunt starts up, and so the process goes on. Now, this age of witch hunting in the time of Shakespeare, in the time of King James, did not go on forever. Although there were a very large number of witch hunts around the North Sea in this period, eventually this whole phase of witch hunting faded out. I've mentioned Matthew Hopkins and the witch scares of the home counties in and around 1645, but I pointed out briefly that they were actually quite late in the procedure. By the end of the English Civil War, which the last battle was in 1646, King Charles was executed in the January of 1649, by the end of that Civil War period, and with the establishment of the Commonwealth government in England, basically the main age of the witch hunts was over. The 16th century and the first half of the 17th century had come to an end, and all around the North Sea, not just in England, and apparently without any reference whatever to the Civil War, the great era of witch accusations came to an end, and so far it has never resumed. Of course, I hesitate to say with confidence that such a thing will never happen again, but it is a unique era, certainly in the English and Scottish histories of which it forms a part. Is it possible to make any sense of this? Clearly, in general terms, all of us are exposed to the possibility of witch hunting because all of us have within us the potentiality for believing in witches and the basic elements of witchcraft fear, which I dealt with last week. Why should this area around the North Sea have been so prone to witch accusations and therefore to escalating witch fears at this particular time? Now, in very simple terms, that is not an easy question to answer. Historians are not agreed about what happened. The documentation, as I pointed out already, is lavish, but trying to make sense of the period of great witch fear causes a great deal of acrimonious dispute between historians, and to step in here would be injudicious. It would be tactless to move in where angels fear to tread. However, a few observations about what was happening at the time are in place here, because one thing that is very striking to anyone who's interested in anthropology or the general understanding of human behaviour is that this period of witch hunting is clearly not a random event. It occurs in a particular period, it begins and it ends, it is associated with a quite particular geographical area. Remarkably, southern and eastern Europe were not involved in this period to any great extent. And one is therefore tempted to say, surely there must be certain forms of correlation which are going on here. Surely it is possible to discover the processes which are involved here. And a few observations, as I say, do seem to be in order. First of all, let's look around to see if there are any other events taking place at this time. What was happening at the beginning of the modern period in precisely this northwestern area of Europe? Let me emphasize what I've said already. If we go eastwards, away from the North Sea, as we move beyond the German-speaking area of Lower Saxony in the broad sense, as we enter Poland and Lithuania, we find that witchcraft accusations and witch hunting die away very rapidly. By the time you get into the Russias, there is really no trace of them at all. The people who belonged to the Russian Orthodox Church were not involved in witch hunting at this period. There is no attention to witch hunting at this time if you read your way through histories of the Russias. As you go southwards, interestingly enough, the same process seems to occur. As you enter the French-speaking area of Europe, south of the North Sea, you find again that there is some witch hunting at this time in the north of France, but that as one goes towards the Mediterranean, the whole era of emphatic witch hunting simply phases out. As you cross the Pyrenees, you find yourself in a part of Europe where there is really no unusual witch accusation activity. There is some interest in witches, but then that is something one finds in other times and in other places. Similarly, in Italian-speaking Europe, south of the Alps, in the Italian peninsula in Sicily, you don't find any great interest in witchcraft at this time, nothing unusual. The general knowledge of witchcraft, of course, as always, but no witch hunting on the scale one associates with the reign of King James in Britain. So that one really does have here a phenomenon which is not vague, which is not something which is totally out of a context. There is a context here. It is northwestern Europe, which is the home of the great witch hunts. Why is that? Is it possible to make sense of it? What about correlation? Can we correlate this with anything else that is happening? Well, yes, we can. One conspicuous feature of precisely the area which I have now characterized is that this is Protestant Europe. It is precisely here that Protestantism took shape and spread. It is precisely here that governments took over control of the national churches. It is precisely here that governments broke with Rome. It is precisely here that the monasteries were disbanded. And therefore, in terms of sheer correlation, we can say, very simply, witch hunting is associated with the origins of Protestant Europe. That doesn't, of course, tell us why witch hunting faded out, because Protestant Europe stayed Protestant right through the 17th century and right through the 18th century. The Protestant break with Rome proved to be a durable feature of modern European history. But Protestants get rarer as you go eastwards through Poland and Lithuania. Protestants get rarer as you go southwards through France, and rarer still as you enter the Spains south of the Pyrenees. In Orthodox Europe, Protestantism, for practical purposes, was non-existent. Greeks, Bulgarians, Serbs, Russians have never had a Reformation, so-called. If there are any Protestants in these countries today, they are, in a sense, Protestants by a process of immigration from further west. Is it possible to correlate the witch hunts with any other feature of what was going on in this time and in this area? Well, perhaps not so clearly. The Protestant correlation does seem to be the clear one, though I ought to emphasise with all these lectures, there's of course a great deal of scope for you to do some investigations of your own. One of the problems with lecture series is that they are by their nature very brief and very restricted. One can't cover the enormous amount of detail, for example, associated with the trials for witchcraft that were occurring at this time in a lecture which runs for the standard length allotted by the timetable. Nevertheless, one can't really let go of the Protestant connection. And although I don't want to expand a discussion of this type, because after all this is only one lecture in the series, a few quick comments are perhaps worth making. What exactly was happening in this area around the North Sea during the early Protestant period? And one observation that can perhaps be made about this, which sets this area apart from southwestern Europe or apart from eastern Europe, is that this was a time in which confidence was being undermined. I've pointed out already that these people round the North Sea did not have well-established ways of finding witches through the feudal period anyway. But at the same time, they did have a well-established socio-ritual order with a clearly defined priesthood, the priesthood of the Western Christian Church. With the increasing scepticism about the efficacy of that clergy, one of the things that happened in this period at this time was that there was really nobody between the ordinary people and the machinations of the witches. With a clergy that was suspect, because their efficacy was not necessarily to be trusted, the possibility existed for two things to happen. One was that most people, faced with an increasing fear of witches, didn't have anyone to turn to. They didn't know where to look for help, and hence, of course, the emergence of people like Matthew Hopkins and the other self-made witch-finders. In a way, of course, one could argue that the clergy weren't doing their job properly. But another thing that can be said is that it is quite likely that there was a real upsurge of witch practice at this time. Large numbers of people may well have actually been practicing witchcraft. The evidence brought before the courts and the evidence given by the witnesses in England and in Scotland that they had seen people behaving in a witchy sort of way, this may not be fantasy. It may not be false evidence. It does seem quite likely that there was a lot of witchcraft going on at this time, and hence the increasing fear of it. In other words, if you live in a system where the fundamental foundations of confidence are being shaken, and there is good reason to believe that in early Protestant Europe that was happening, then, of course, all sorts of things start breaking loose. People start being wicked. People start practicing malign activities against their neighbours. It is often assumed by self-consciously enlightened people in suburban England in the 1990s that the people who were sent to their deaths by the magistrates in England and Scotland during the reign of King James were innocent people, that we are dealing here with fantasy. I'm not convinced of that. I suspect, with Margaret Murray, that many of these people who were sent to their deaths were witches, that they were people who practiced witchcraft, and that the magistrates in many cases conducted the cases very fairly and did arrive at conclusions that were in accordance with the evidence. These were people who had gone out and taken part in various kinds of Sabbath sort of activities. Now, it's easy to comment at great length about what happened in that period. I don't want to do that, but there are a few observations which really are worth making still. One of them is this. When you look at the records of the English and the Scottish courts, you look at the people who were hanged at this time, you realise, of course, and this point has been made over and over again, that the vast majority of them were actually women. At the same time, of course, one should make another point, and that is that some of them were actually men. The reasons for that does require some detailed examination. I'm not going to do it now, but it's worth making a point about this process. By the time of Shakespeare and of King James, apparently very large numbers of people did assume that a lot of people practicing witchcraft would be women. If you go back to the beginnings of England, say in the 10th century, if you go back to the time of the Angles and the Saxons, and if you look at the practice of witchcraft in modern tropical Africa or other tropical areas, you'll find that there is no assumption whatever that a witch will be female. A witch could be equally male or female. One of the strange things that's happened in English history is that there has been a gradual drift from the beginning of the feudal period to the end of the modern period when we live, an increasing drift of confidence that a witch by nature must be female. This is something that is worth coming back to on some other occasion. I won't elaborate it now. In Shakespeare's time, it seems to have been assumed that the vast majority of witches, if not quite all, would be female. Nowadays, if you go out into the streets and ask people to describe a witch, virtually without exception in England or in Scotland, they will describe a woman. Witchcraft has shifted from its original fixed point, where a witch was a wicked person, male or female, through a time in the early modern period where, in practice, witches are likely to be female rather than male, to the present situation where it is taken absolutely for granted that a witch will always be female without exception. If you ask people, well, what would you call somebody who is sort of like a witch but not female, they will cast around to find some other word, but they won't find the word witch. Witches are female, we know that. Now, this is part of all sorts of confusing processes which are associated with the modern period, particularly in northwestern Europe and in places which have been colonised from northwestern Europe, places like Canada, the United States, Australia, New Zealand. The processes are very complicated and are beyond the scope of a course of this kind on ritual and belief in an anthropological context. But again, they're too interesting to be entirely ignored. And one of the things which one has to bear in mind when one is looking at the whole process of witchcraft in the modern period is the process which I've referred to already as the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment is something which is perhaps quite difficult to define, but it is a self-conscious movement which picked up, I suppose, from the end of the 17th century and became stronger through the 18th and into the 19th. The Enlightenment is very strongly associated by many historians with the French Revolution, and by some of them at least certainly with the American Declaration of Independence. And although it's a slightly intangible movement, like the Romantic movement which accompanies it, it can, I suppose, be characterised in various ways. It is strongly associated with the countries round the North Sea, and that includes France, particularly the northern half of France. And it is much less closely associated, say, with the Russias or with the Balkans or with the areas south of the Pyrenees and the Alps. And it is tempting, of course, for anyone who wants to put forward a general theory of European history to link the Enlightenment in some way with the witch hunts. Is it possible that the Enlightenment is the next phase of Northwest European history which follows after the witch hunts? Is there even a possibility, and this theory has been put forward, that the Enlightenment is the dialectical reaction to the witch hunts, that after a period in which people had thoroughly disgusted themselves by their own total incapacity to cope with their own fears and their own self-delusions, people turned to a world which was much more uplifting, a world in which one took much more notice of empirical evidence, a world in which formalized science became very fashionable and very much a part of the interest of any learned gentleman, and a world in which one could turn one's back upon the dreadful superstition and the outrageous hysterical behaviour of one's recent ancestors. I don't want to push this theory. It certainly is one that we've got to look at. Is it possible that the Northwest Europeans jumped from the frying pan of witch hunting into the fire of the Enlightenment? Possibly they did. It's certainly a dialectical interpretation that's got to be looked at, but I'm not going to elaborate anything about it now. What I am going to say is that for anyone who's interested in the history of anthropology, in the study of human behaviour as that has developed in Europe from 1600 through to 2000, what one can say is that the Enlightenment has had a very big part in the development of the study of other cultures and of other peoples. That the developments in physics and in chemistry, the developments in mathematics, the developments in exploration, in geography and in cartography, which we associate with the Enlightenment, with this turning towards a quest for knowledge and understanding, a development of theorising, and an interest in facts, the accumulation and the publishing of facts on a grand scale. All of this associated with the Enlightenment has had an effect, a very important effect, on the development of anthropology, and it has also affected, in ways that are not perhaps quite so happy, the sorts of attitudes which anthropologists have had towards other cultures, towards the people who don't live in Europe, who don't live in North Africa, who don't live in the Near East, who don't live around the Mediterranean. The peoples who don't live in the old, familiar world of feudal people, the world of Christendom, and the world of Darul Islam, the world of the Muslims, but who live beyond that, who live in the Americas, who live in sub-Saharan Africa, who live in the Indian subcontinent and Southeast Asia, and who live beyond that in the Pacific Islands and in Australia. And what has tended to happen with the Enlightenment is that there has come into existence a dogmatic view of what knowledge is. A critic of the Enlightenment, and I'm not very fond of the Enlightenment myself, a critic of the Enlightenment would say that the Enlightenment should be called the Endarkenment and that it was a time of dogmatic ignorance. The Enlightenment introduced not only Newtonian physics and indeed eventually Einsteinian physics, it introduced not only modern geography, modern anthropology and modern natural history, but it also introduced dogmatic views about ritual and about belief. It became, for example, shameful for people in the literate classes to admit that they were frightened of ghosts. It became shameful to admit that you were afraid of being bewitched. It became shameful to participate in the beliefs of peasant peoples or people who lived in rainforests on the other side of the world. One got involved in a dogmatic view of what was possible. I've referred to this briefly in the first lecture because I said that actually we haven't done any research on whether witchcraft works. We have all grown up in a world where it is taken for granted that witchcraft doesn't work, and therefore we need not take it seriously. This is a thoroughly unscientific, a thoroughly non-empirical approach to a very important part of human behaviour and human knowledge. For all I know, witchcraft may well work very well. I'm quite prepared to believe that large numbers of people who practice witchcraft can't actually do it. But I wouldn't stick my neck out and say that there aren't some real witches out there doing it very effectively at the present time, not only here, but in other parts of the world too. The Enlightenment has certainly coloured our views. All the evidence that I can see suggests that the Enlightenment is now at an end, that with the end of the modern period, the Enlightenment too is fading, and it may well be that the Enlightenment's accompaniment and sidekick, the Romantic movement, is also fading, though it seems to me there's rather less evidence for that than there is for the fading of the Enlightenment. One of the things that's happened in northwestern Europe at the end of the 20th century has been that more and more people are prepared to take witchcraft seriously. More and more people are prepared to consider the possibility that there might be ghosts. After all, in virtually all human societies, until the Enlightenment in northwestern Europe, both the existence of ghosts and the existence of witchcraft have been taken for granted by the great majority of people. And it is therefore very odd that the literate elite of Europe should set themselves up claiming that these particular bodies of knowledge, which have never been thoroughly tested, are simply nonsense and can be ignored. A very good example of the bind into which the modern literate Europeans have got themselves is provided by the opera singer Dame Clara Butt of a previous age, who was once asked, do you believe in ghosts? She replied, no, but I'm afraid of them. And this is very much the fate of the Enlightenment Northwest European of the present time. There are huge numbers of people in this country, for example, who would claim, if asked boldly, that they certainly are not afraid of ghosts. But on their way home from the station after dark, they never walk through the graveyard. And that, of course, is typical of people in other parts of the world, less enlightened people like Africans, Amerindians and Polynesians, who certainly would never walk through a graveyard after dark, because, after all, you never know whom you might meet there. That's the old-fashioned human attitude. The Enlightenment has challenged that, has made it more difficult to be honest about what human fears really are. Now, a comment on the Enlightenment is not out of place at this point in a discussion of witchcraft, and it may be necessary for me to make more observations about the Enlightenment as we go through the series because, as I say, modern anthropology is so coloured by this process which we call the Enlightenment or the Endarkenment or whatever. It's worth pointing out that the Enlightenment has not really saved us from witch hunting in the strict sense. Because if you look at the United States in the period after 1945, you see what some people regard as one of the greatest witch hunts that has ever occurred in the history of the world. It is true that it was not a witch hunt in the true sense, and therefore the modesty of the Enlightenment has been saved, as of course it was not saved in Salem, Massachusetts at an earlier period. But the search for reds under the beds, which is associated with Senator Joseph McCarthy and his intensive investigations into people who were practicing subversive and un-American activities at that time, the period around 1950, is rightly called a witch hunt by the American journalists because although there was no search for witches as such, there was no implication of witchcraft as such. As far as I can see, and as far as anybody I know can see, the processes which were involved in the McCarthy, quote, quote, witch hunting, what the journalists called witch hunting, were exactly the same in broad character as the activities of Matthew Hopkins and his kind in 17th century England. This was a witch hunt. The journalists who called it that got it right. They'd got the spirit of the thing absolutely right. That is what happened. And, of course, characteristic of all witch hunts, this one collapsed. There came a point where people were so frightened of the witch hunters that they turned against them and forgot about the witches, in this case the reds under the beds. Of course there were reds under the beds, we all know there were. But whether you can find them by these methods is just as doubtful as whether you can find the witches who were, I suspect, really practicing in the home counties of England in Matthew Hopkins' time by the methods which Hopkins himself advocated. Beware of witch hunters. At the end of the day, they may be more dangerous than the witches you fear themselves. Some more comments about what has happened to the very word witchcraft in modern times. We must never forget the impact of the Enlightenment. We must never forget the searing impact of those extraordinary witch hunts of the early modern period. But the word witchcraft itself seems to be drifting even further from its moorings than I've indicated already. I've mentioned the point that witches have become, to a very large extent, in spoken and written English, women. If you say the word witch to a schoolboy at the present time in England, he will assume immediately, pretty certainly, that you are talking about a woman and not about a man. This is a shift in the meaning of the word that is quite significant and which does require a certain amount of explaining. Something has happened to the English, something has happened to the Scots, something has happened to the English language in the years since 1400, since 1500. There has been a definite shift here, which is unmistakable. It can't be simply shrugged off, it can't be brushed away. It's definitely there. And other things have happened too. One of these features, very remarkable, is the way in which witches nowadays appear on television. Some middle-aged woman wearing a smart tweed suit will turn up on the television and tell you that, oh yes, she is a witch. And indeed, all her best friends are witches. Witchcraft is not now something which necessarily has to be kept undercover. The normal status of the witch, I indicated quite clearly at the beginning of this series, witchcraft is a criminal practice. Those people who do it are no more forthcoming about their activities than are, say, bank robbers or drug runners. Witchcraft has always been a very difficult subject for anyone, anthropologists or sociologists or anybody, or the police, to investigate, because the people who engage in it have always been very, very cautious about letting on who they are. It's therefore strange that we should live in a period of British Isles history when there are people who are quite happy to proclaim themselves to be witches and even to evangelise. They're even eager to get converts who will become witches and join them. What has happened in this process? Well, broadly speaking, I mean, one could put it in strictly linguistic terms and say, simply, the word witchcraft has changed its meaning. I mean, we're simply not dealing now with the witchcraft of the Angles and the Saxons. We're not even dealing with the witchcraft of Shakespeare, though even in Shakespeare's time, the word was beginning to shift its meaning. If you look at a very famous point in Shakespearean writing where witches, so-called, are involved, you realise, of course, that these people who are called witches in Macbeth are not strictly witches at all. What they're doing is not witchcraft, but they are essentially seers. These people are people who have what the Scots call the second sight. What they're practising may be witchcraft, they may be doing some witchcraft as well, but what is important for the plot of the play is not their practice as witchcrafts, but their ability as seers. It's the fact that they know the future that is so important to the thrust of the drama. And therefore, of course, Shakespeare is already using witch in a way which indicates that the word is coming away from its old Anglo-Saxon and Jutish moorings. Since then, it has come even further afield. But a further observation which might interest you about the use of language, at the same time that Shakespeare was writing, of course, broadly in that same period, King James was sponsoring a new translation of the Bible into the English tongue. And that version of the Bible, still readily available to all of you, was published in 1611. And in it, there are various references to witchcraft. Witchcraft was, of course, forbidden under the Jewish law, as you would expect. But the most interesting example of so-called witchcraft in the Bible is not actually witchcraft at all. In the story of Saul, Jonathan, and David, you will remember that a woman at Endor raises the prophet Samuel from the dead so that Saul, the king, can speak to him. This woman is called a witch, but if we actually look at the text very clearly, it is quite clear to us that although she is practicing something which is forbidden under the Jewish law, you're not allowed to raise the dead under the Jewish law, nevertheless, what she was doing was not witchcraft, it was necromancy. She was doing something quite different. And this again, of course, shows you that in King James' time, in Shakespeare's time, the English language was drifting away. Witchcraft is changing its meaning. When I began discussing this subject at the beginning of the series, what I said was that if you ask schoolchildren in Basildon these days, what does witchcraft mean, they're quite likely to tell you that it is sort of that it's almost anything spooky. You know, that witchcraft has come to mean the spooky. And we can see, of course, in the King James Version and in Shakespeare's play Macbeth, that that process is already beginning. King James translators and the dramatist Shakespeare are beginning to drift away from the old meaning. They're beginning to drift away from witchcraft, as I've been talking about it in the early part of the series. Why this should happen, I don't know. I'm not going to try and explain how languages drift any more than I'm going to try and explain sound shifts, which linguists are always going on about. But the point is, there is little doubt here that witchcraft is shifting its meaning. There are now people in England who belong to witch societies and who behave very much as if they were a nonconformist sect. That is, what has happened is that witchcraft has become an open, non-secret cult activity. To be a witch is not basically much different from being a Jew or being a Methodist or being a Baptist or belonging to a revivalistic, Anglican, evangelical, charismatic house group. That to be a witch is really to be one of a number of cult groups going on at the present time. You have your own distinctive practices. The witches claim that they are practicing the old pre-Christian cult of the British and that they are going back to their cultural roots. There are very strong empirical grounds for doubting that particular claim, but I won't elaborate them here. Suffice it to say that what they are doing is always strongly anti-Christian and that the witches always want, like other groups who claim to be neo-pagans at the present time, they want to cut themselves off from the Christian church, they want to cut themselves off from the Bible, they want to cut themselves off from the Jews, they want to cut themselves off from the whole historic background of metaphysical and theological development in Europe over the last 1500 or so years. That's interesting, but it takes us far beyond witchcraft in the strict sense in which I began this series. So at this point I want to halt this discussion. We've drifted very far from the original point, and instead I want to look forward to the next lecture, in which I want to discuss not only witchcraft yes, but also the way in which witchcraft fits into the whole pattern of human assumptions about the spirit world and about what is going on around them. And particularly, I want to look, as a starting point, at the whole process, which can, I suppose, be called reversal, that process by which people believe that what goes on in the superhuman world is the opposite of what goes on here in the ordinary mundane world of the here and now. Next week, then, reversal.